I realized as I was preparing this talk that there are actually two different questions on the table. I've been asking, how do we change network service provisioning so the internet survives? But the telephone companies and cable companies have been asking, how do we change the internet so we survive? And funny how Congress seems to be answering the second question first. The talk really talks around these two questions and the tension between them. The summary of the talk is that telephone companies are in very deep, very real, serious business crises. More than one of them, but it is a crisis. The stupid network has succeeded technically and economically, but has some elements that are quite unsustainable, specifically the telephone companies who run the physical underpinnings, the infrastructure. It's about to drive them out of business. And the telephone companies want to, because they're in crisis, they're looking around for more cash and they want to enter video. And they want to participate in application revenue, which by virtue of the layering of the internet, they've been cut out of. Hopefully we'll open it up and I'll discuss common carriage network neutrality and the COPE bill, which stands for Communications Opportunity but notice it's not something grandiose like Patriot or Clean Skies. COPE is actually kind of defensive word. It's kind of, we're coping here. We're not being grandiose about it. We just had a couple other people come in. Do they want to introduce themselves? You know how to do this, right?
Sure. Hi, I'm Elizabeth Tuell here at HLS. Work with Berkman on various projects, and I've been very interested in SaveTheInternet.com and all these initiatives about net neutrality.
Neat. Good.
I'm Brian Peterson. I'm at Tuell here at HLS. Elizabeth just came
in. Okay.
Rightfully so.
Well, we'll see about that. Here's the shape of the telephone company's crisis. The hump there in telephone, it's not really telephone penetration. What they're doing is taking the number of wireline telephones and dividing by the number of households or vice versa. Anyway, it's the penetration peaked at something like 95%. That includes second lines, fax lines, and so on like that. If you project, you'll see that the trend downward, the loss of lines, is accelerating. So it's not wrong to take that as a projection. March 2007 is when it hit its 80% penetration by straight line, naive straight line interpolation, which isn't too bad. 80% is about where telephone companies start to run into trouble and start to run into profitability problems.
I had a quick question regarding this.
Sure.
Is this only in reference to landlines?
Landlines.
Okay. As I know, like, a lot of my friends and a lot of maybe college and grad students just don't have landlines anymore.
That's right.
Okay, so this is being displaced primarily by wireless.
That's one of the things that's happening is that wireless is taking over, but people are losing their second lines, and I suspect, frankly, that the poor are increasing for the very first time since the Depression, and I suspect that there are people who can't afford a landline telephone. And there are other things going on. I mean, email. I hardly use the telephone at all anymore. I use email and chat. Why do I need to talk to anybody?
Is there a sense that Skype is also a factor in this or no?
It is probably undetectable, but the telephone companies see that as part of this crisis. There's no question that Skype and Vonage and other forms of internet telephony are on their radar screen. If you look at the last, these data points are every 4 months. And if you look at the last, and they end in March of 2005, but if you take the last 5 or 6 of them, you can do another naive linear projection that says that you get to 80% in approximately New Year's Day of 2011. In any case, in telco time is slower than real time. Internet time is faster, but telco time, that's like tomorrow. And so the telephone companies really need a bill. In fact, they needed a bill years ago. If they need in their sense, they need to survive. Urs, thank you for reminding me. Let me completely jump out of my storyline and say that there is a basket of buttons on the table here for one web day. One web day, the first one web day will be September 11th. Erica just brought in the a bunch of posters. The posters say there's a one web day brainstorming party here in Cambridge a week from today at 7 p.m., Tuesday, May 9th at 7 p.m., at John Harvard's Brew Pub, 33 Dunster Street in Harvard Square. Come help celebrate the internet, and wear your One Web Day button. Please take a One Web Day button and wear it. Pass them around. And come to this. Susan Crawford will be here. In fact, we were just talking about the possibility. Susan, if you're listening, apparently our lunch speaker canceled, so we have an opening for a lunch speaker. Susan, are you there? anyway, so the One Web Day Boston brainstorming party is 1 week from today, and I'm going to be there. I encourage all of you to be there, too. It's nonpartisan enough that even these telephone companies could participate. Okay, so telephone companies are in crisis. The number of long-distance minutes is decreasing. Again, landline minutes. Or I think this includes landline to mobile and or mobile to landline, but probably not mobile to mobile, since the FCC is so siloized that the wireless division and the wireline division probably don't have, I mean, they probably don't even talk to each other. They probably don't even have coffee break in the same restaurant. Here's another one that shows that the telco crisis, they're laying off, especially in wireline. Now, if you look at the yellow line at the bottom and the cable has, I would say, within 10% of the number of, probably about the same number of subscribers as wireline telephony. But look at how many fewer employees they have than wireline telephony. And now they're offering internet service, and they're not really increasing their employees. So there's a second crisis coming. And that's because the cost basis of wireline telephone companies is so high. Cellular guys are down there in that very low tier. They're the purple line. The telephone companies are looking around. The solid gray bars are cable TV revenues. The crosshatched bars are broadband revenues. But just look at the solid gray bars. Those are growing between 4 and 9% a year. And the telephone companies want a piece of that, but there's a problem. There's 10,000 franchising authorities just in Verizon's territory alone. I think it's more like 20-some-odd thousand cable franchising authorities nationwide. And Rick Boucher, the congressman on the Telecom and Internet Subcommittee of the House, he said at Freedom to Connect that Verizon's been working this problem very actively, and they're getting about 15 new franchises a year. So they want a federal solution to that problem. So the main driver of the new telecom bills, the bill in the Senate, the bill in the House, the main driver is the telephone companies want to do video. Their biggest barrier is these gazillion franchising authorities, and they want one federal franchising procedure that preempts all of these cities and counties and utility districts. And so, I have no problem with that. There are lots of other problems. I, as a nethead, have no problem with that, but the people who are involved in cable TV and community control and so on have a big problem with it, and so I feel an alliance with them. One thing I can say for sure is that video entertainment is a zero-sum game, meaning if we have competition, the pie is growing at 4 to 9%. If we have competition, it's probably going to increase the costs to the end user, and probably not really. Well, it won't increase the number of hours a day that we can watch. What's the benefit? What's the big innovation? I fail to see it. So the telephone companies are looking down the road, and they see that the Vonages and the Skypes, and they see the fact that they used to have all these second lines because people were dialing into this thing called the Internet, and now that's going away because the cable companies first got the cable companies first started in this country with high-speed cable modem service. Telephone companies, even though they had DSL first, they were late out of the gate. If you look at DSL, its primary penetration is where cable already is. And anyway, so the telephone companies don't really understand the Internet, but they see this thing where all of the services, the valuable services, Skype and Vonage and email and so on, are moving to the edge of the network. The services are created by smart network-enabled products, not by big network-centric companies. And you just bring home these products and plug them in. And they don't like what they see. Now, since the demise of Bell Labs, which I put at just about January 2nd of 1998, that's the day I quit, since then it just hasn't been what it used to be. But it's been
ever...
It was published in something like July or August of September of 97.
Okay,
yeah. I wrote it on Memorial Day weekend of 97. I would say that right now, Internet 2 is the premier U.S. networking research effort. And the Vice President for External Affairs testified in the Senate hearing on February 7th of this year, and he said, our engineers started with the assumption that we should find technical ways of prioritizing certain kinds of bits. We seriously explored various quality of service schemes. All of our research and practical experience supported the conclusion that it was far more cost-effective to simply provide more bandwidth. With enough bandwidth in the network, there is no congestion, and video bits do not need preferential treatment. And he goes on, today, our Abilene network does not give preferential treatment. That is, it does not discriminate. It does HDTV, it does high-quality two-way video conferences, thousands simultaneously. It transfers huge files without loss of packets. He didn't say at a low loss of packet rate or anything. He said without loss of packets. And he concludes, rather than introduce additional complexity into the network fabric and additional costs to implement these prioritizing techniques, the telecom providers, the U.S. telecom providers, should focus on providing Americans with an abundance of bandwidth, and the quality problems will take care of themselves. This is so important that I've even got two more slides on this. He said, I was standing up and cheering as he was saying this, by the way. I literally, it was like your favorite team scored a goal. I could not restrain myself. This was so good. He said, a gigabit Ethernet connection would only need a $15 card. This is for residential service. A gigabit. A gigabit is enough throughput to provide 60 conventional telephony at 64 kilobits to 100,000 household city. And we have gigabit interfaces on our high-end laptops today. A gigabit would need a $15 card. If the provider, on the other hand, if the provider divides up the bandwidth into telephony service, video service, internet service, the resulting set-top box might cost as much as $150. Right now, Verizon says $300 to $500 is what they cost to actually install service on a house that's passed by fiber. And Batchelor, the Internet 2 VP of External Affairs, concludes, simple is cheaper, complex is costly, and finally he winds up his talk by saying, open, inexpensive, and simple is better than costly, complex, and closed. This is the voice of science speaking. This isn't some arm-waving advocate from the Berkman Center for hippie internet advocacy. This is the premier conclusion of the leading U.S. network research effort. Why should we care whether the network is centralized and closed or diverse, decentralized, and open? It's simply because every application that we use and love and care about in the last decade has been built because the network is stupid. The telephone companies knew about all this stuff, but they didn't know how to bring it to market. So when the network was stupid, it just came to market anyway. So a few years ago, David Weinberger and I wrote a paper called The Paradox of the Best Network, which, if I had to summarize it in a sentence, I would say, when the middle of the network is empty, when the network is stupid and just delivers the bits, and bandwidth is plentiful, so there's no scarcity there, what do network service providers sell? And that, to me, remains the single most important question that we have yet to answer. Now, back to the telephone company view. The telephone companies are used to thinking of their business as a vertical value chain where if you scratch, I mean, they don't really explicitly think of it like this, but if you scratch away the surface, these are the assumptions immediately underneath the bellhead's thinking, that you charge a monthly fee for the application, for the ability to pick up the telephone, call somebody, and talk to them, and that that monthly fee subsidizes the network layer and the rights of way and real estate and poles and conduits. Okay, the internetworking model breaks that value chain. It is any application over, there's the portability layer. I don't really have to spend too long on this. Over, it's any application over any network. Okay, so we know that this is advertising driven, and it's subscription driven, and sometimes it's free because we love doing it. But there's well-defined benefits there because we have access to the network. The network itself, the network layer, with the internet protocol, specifically the internet, it's a set of ideas, a set of protocols, that's a commons. It belongs to everybody. Anybody can use it. Anybody can improve it. Nobody owns it. And then there's the physical layer. And the physical layer is still considered to be a public accommodation, common carriage, but it doesn't, they don't participate in the application revenues anymore. So the big question is, what's the business model? What's the operating model down here? And even as a nethead, honestly, this has concerned me for a couple of years, even though I want to change the provisioning so that the internet survives, I'm still really concerned who runs the physical layer in a sustainable way. Okay, now it gets back to common carriage. And common carriage goes, people say common carriage is dead. It isn't really dead, but common carriage is significantly weaker in telecommunications than it once was. Question.
So if we could go back to the last slide.
Yes.
The network layer, you say it's a commons. It seems like there is a business model at that layer. For example, one can conceive of bandwidth as being provisioned at that layer, and also addresses such as IP addresses or even other kinds of services like those things could also be provisioned. And we can think of that as being at the network layer as well. Is there a reason why this is conflicting with the idea of commons?
I would say that the structure of the address is what is there. The providing of addresses, good question. I'm not quite sure where that fits. There may be some service business that serves that commons, sort of like if you think of the old commons with the cows grazing on it, it could be there's a feed store right next to the commons that sells feed for the cows that depends on the commons being there. And that's how I would think of addresses, but I'm... good question. Let me go on unless someone else has something. So the common carriage dates back to this notion of a public calling in common law. It's been around since 1100 or 1200. What people who followed a common calling were the blacksmiths, the people who delivered stuff, drayage people, and so on. I guess they were called teamsters. I don't know. Anyway, people who weren't directly connected to a patrimonial estate followed these public callings. And so someone would come to shoe your horse, and if they held themselves out as a farrier or a blacksmith, they had to, they couldn't say, I'll shoe your horse, but not your horse. And they couldn't say, I'll charge you one price and I'll charge you another price. They had to charge a common price and a just price. And they had to, if they said they were a blacksmith, they had to be moderately, they had to be competent in the art. So it referred to both itinerants, like tinkers and tailors and so on, and also to people with place-based businesses like millers and ferrymen. The first application, I think, to a communications network came with the first communications network, which was the telegraph. And there was a Western Union versus somebody named Call. It was Western Union versus Call something in 1901. And the I haven't read the decision, but I've read a summary of it, and the summary says that the Supreme Court said that Western Union had a duty of non-discrimination, even if there wasn't a statute, because Western Union was a common carrier. Then along came the Communications Act of 1934, and Title II of the Communications Act, which is in play today, it says that you're a common carrier if you offer communication service to the public for hire. So then after 34, and acceleratingly, common carriage has now, the obligations in telecommunications have gotten weaker and weaker. The modified final judgment, which broke up the Bell system in 84, and the computer inquiry too, it was in the 1980s. 1980 there is a, that's a typo, I will fix it. CI2 was in the 80s, computer inquiry 1 and 3, but CI2 is the one that separated basic services from enhanced services. And basic services come with their, like, the connection, the dial tone, the actual talking. Enhanced services had a protocol conversion, and so you added, the telephone company was thought of as adding something to it. Basic services are subject to common carriage, and specifically to interconnection and non-discrimination. Enhanced services aren't. That's important because internet service provider, that decision right there allowed for the growth of the dial-up internet, because it said that dial-up was a basic service. So you had a call, the telephone company had a provision you when you call anywhere, and internet services had a protocol conversion. You converted from this modem signal to digital, and therefore they were enhanced services. So the enhanced services, the ISPs themselves, were not subject to common carriage. The basic services were, even though the telephone companies didn't like it, they did not want to let you dial up an internet service. Not that they wanted to be an internet service, they specifically refused being it. But they didn't, you know, it was big company monopoly conservatism, monopoly heritage conservatism that made it not happen. So, anyway, since 2000, especially recently since 2000, the common carriage obligations of carriers have gotten weaker and weaker. And now, today, with the various fiber-to-the-home decisions, fiber's not subject to many common carriage duties, obligations. Cable modem service, by virtue of the Supreme Court's Brand X decision, is freed of many common carriage obligations. The FCC immediately said, we have to level the playing field now, so they made DSL not subject to many common carriage decisions. And now, very recently, like last month and the last few weeks, the FCC has let lapse a petition by Verizon. Verizon petitioned to be exempted from Title II, which is the common carriage rule, and Computer Inquiry II, which is the rule that created basic services. So right now, as we sit here in this room, there are very few and very weak common carrier obligations on the basic layer 0 through 2 of the internet. And in a sense, what that did was it put this value stack on the right there. It put it back together by saying not that it said that physical layer there was the same as all those other applications, or that it and now it allows, for example, an AT&T. You know, Ed Whitaker at AT&T said they're not going to use my pipes for free, and now, by rule, he is free to go and ask them for money. Will he do it? Good question. The law is not settled, and let me go forward. So, so will he do it? So here we have Ed Whitaker saying, they ain't going to use my pipes for free, and we've got weaker and weaker obligations about what those pipes are used for. And so citizens are coming back and saying, listen, we want something, okay, that their network neutrality is common carriage. And citizens now increasingly are starting to realize that they're about to lose some really basic things. So now is network neutrality, I think network neutrality. Network neutrality is common carriage. That I'm not sure if that's strictly equals or if it's more like, I think network neutrality is common carriage the way a robin is a bird. It's a sort of a subset. But the critical thing about this bird is that it's about non-discrimination with regard to what it's carried, what is carried, where it came from, where it is going. The internet's success is because it's content and service agnostic, source and destination agnostic, device and application agnostic. Here's two views of discrimination. Here's the citizen's view. There's a recent story about some venue shut off a band because in the mid-performance. And there's no reason why an ISP couldn't do similar if they didn't have an obligation not to discriminate. And here's the telco's view is, wow, we get to participate in all that application revenue that's now going to Google and eBay and Yahoo and stuff like that. So the technology of discrimination has arrived. It used to be that in the old days, the network couldn't discriminate if it wanted to, but now we have contingent routing, port blocking, application detection, deep packet inspection, and all kinds of other intelligence that we can put in the middle of the network and run just as fast as a fiber runs. So we've got means, motive, and opportunity for the crime of violating network neutrality. Now, here we come to the current bill in front of the House. It was scheduled to be voted on day after tomorrow, but apparently it has hit a little roadblock. And also there's been a similar bill introduced in the Senate. So there are five titles. First one is Franchise Reform to Get the Telephone Companies into Video. The second one is Enforcement of the FCC's Broadband Policy Statement, which we can talk about at some length or not if people want to talk about something else. There's a 911 requirement for voice over IP. There's a municipal services title, which is actually quite good at keep states from banning cities from building their own networks. And then there's a standalone broadband services title that I think is so weak it's bound to disappear. I don't want to talk about it. Not right now, given the time. The Powell FCC promulgated these four internet freedoms, so-called. Freedom to access legal content, freedom to run applications, freedom to attach devices subject to restrictions of the service plan, and freedom to get plain English explicit service plan information about throughput and packet loss and so on like that. The Martin FCC significantly watered these down. Instead of freedoms, they're called entitlements. An entitlement sounds much weaker than a freedom. And the Martin FCC published them with a lot of weasel words. And we can talk about the weasel words if you want to. But basically, look at footnote 4. All these principles are subject to reasonable network management. Now, the COPE bill says that the FCC can enforce the Martin principles, but how are you going to enforce an entitlement to competition, for example? Here's the weaknesses. It specifically forbids FCC rulemaking for enforcement, and it says that the FCC can only make orders regarding violations on a case-by-case basis. So if I think that, say, Verizon's discriminating against me, and I bring it to the FCC, and 90 days later they say, yes, indeed, there actually is a violation there, well, that's fine, but then Professor Palfrey has the same exact problem with Verizon, and he goes to the FCC. He has to go to the FCC by himself on a case-by-case basis, and then the FCC has to make an individual decision about his problem, or maybe it's a slightly different problem, and then they can do an order. But they can't. What they can't do is make rules in advance that say if you block this address, that's discrimination. They can't do that. Now, furthermore, the four Martin principles don't cover access to content. They don't prohibit offering of tiered services so that Google is faster than Yahoo Search and New York Times is faster than, not Boston Globe because that's the same company, but New York Times is faster than Washington Post. They don't block that. They don't speak to the issue of how degraded can a service be before it violates one of these entitlement to access. I mean, is entitlement to access entitled to access degraded content? Well, maybe if it's a little degraded, maybe not. Anyway, so it seems to me that without enforcement rules, this is just no law. It's no guarantee. The four principles don't cover price discrimination. Okay? You're entitled to access legal content. Of course, it'll cost you $1,000 a bit. You know? Sure, right. So I'm wondering, is this a whole new category of law? If this thing passed in the way it is, the law says that the FCC can enforce principles that up until now weren't law, they were just a statement of principles, but they can't make rules to enforce those principles. It's like it's a kowtow in the right general direction, but it is so way unenforceable. I just cannot see the legal basis. And apparently nobody else can. The advocates of network neutrality, such as Congressman Markey and Senator Wyden, are still extremely dissatisfied with this.
I think Bob Pearson's actually someone with special knowledge of enforcement.
Oh, good.
Complex technology rules of this sort. And
yes.
Does this strike you as strange, or are there analogs that you can think of that would make this less strange than David has been able to say?
Well, I was wondering what exactly the provision said, because there are certain areas of law where, in fact, they do lay down more general rules of more general applicability, less sort of technology-focused or dependent, and then the way in which they're applied is developed in the case law or in the practice of an agency.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure from David, your description of this, whether that's exactly what they're doing here.
Well, they're
what exactly they're aiming at and trying not to, you know, what kinds of rules are contemplated as not being the kind of thing that they would put in place.
Well, for example, the FCC. Let's just take the entitlement to access legal content. Suppose. I'm entitled to access a website, but access two websites, one of which is on the fast lane, and I get it on my screen, boom, and the other one is on the slow lane, and it's so slow that it takes so a minute for the whole screen to paint. Does that infringe my entitlement or not? Well, should the FCC has no power to say to promulgate standards about what constitutes my entitlement to access legal content? They don't. The law expressly forbids rulemaking about these four principles.
But I guess what I was wondering is whether I understand that point, but whether. Is in some areas where it's developed by the decisions, in essence, a kind of case law of the agency saying, presented with that issue, that they interpreted the mm-hmm. principle at issue mm-hmm. to mean, no, you can't do that, or yes, you can, or you can only do it under certain circumstances.
So, guidance letters.
Yeah, guidance or the principles that they would articulate that then would de facto be out there for some other person deciding whether they can uh-huh. do that or not. Uh-huh. But I mean, I guess that the devil is in the details there as to exactly how the provision is framed to,
right.
to what limits that puts on the agency to develop the kind of guidance. Because it just strikes me it could be either problematic or not, depending on how actually they're permitted to play it out.
The law, I think, is silent on that. In the current FCC, I think they'd be very strongly in favor of the telephone companies, and that burden would be on the complainer. But once there was an order, I mean, if I came and said this website is taking way too long, and the FCC said, "Yep, you're right, it's taking way too long. You got to make that quicker," then if Palfrey came with the same problem, the order would already exist. So, yeah, there would be a sense in which the case could develop. But my impression is that it would be a very long process. Yes?
Now, I'm not a lawyer, but...
neither am I.
but isn't that what courts are for? I mean, essentially, you say the very general principle, such as discrimination is disallowed, and
uh-huh.
then demonstrate discrimination, however it may occur, whether it's slow to load a web page, whether you only successfully load the web page 60% of the time, all these other possible ways in which ISPs can try to distort access to content, and have courts decide whether they're discriminating or not.
Well, you know, it says the FCC has sole authority to adjudicate these, and I don't know whether that means that courts have, that you can take it to court if you don't like what the FCC did or not.
One would presume,
but, you know.
Do you want to get through your...
We're almost done. We're back to the two different questions. The telcos and cable cos are asking, how do we change the internet so we survive? And their answer is to make discrimination legal to allow participation in application revenues. Oh, come on.
Give that the seat for you.
David, you already know what else is going on. You can ask the first question since you know what.
I'm sorry, I'm a little late.
And so citizens are still asking, how do we change network service provisioning so the internet survives? And there, the answer is not so obvious. We have breaking news. As of yesterday, the House bill has been delayed. The best we can hope for is that it's delayed until the next session of Congress. Here's my prognosis is that I'm still fighting, but I think we're going to lose simply because the weight of history is for weaker and weaker common carrier obligations. However, Lessig did a really amazing thing. He turned his Eldred loss in the Supreme Court into the Creative Commons revolution. And if things get bad enough, there may be a lot more activity in really cheap Wi-Fi, Wi-Fi clouds, packet hop, directional antennas. There's all kinds of things. Low power AM and FM as receivers get more sensitive and signal processing multi-element antennas get more capable. So maybe even in the AM band we can do stuff that you couldn't imagine doing 5 or 10 years ago. So, of course, it will push it into the... it'll push the innovative layer 0, 1, and 2 stuff into the shadows. That won't be good. But... thank you.
Second Life will not have seen your last slide, but we can email it to them, right?
Yeah, that would be fine. These slides are available if anyone wants a copy. Just email Erica Colon.
Actually, maybe we could put it up, make the PowerPoint presentation available with the podcast later on.
Okay, the PowerPoint will be with the podcast.
Excellent.
Okay.
All right,
questions, comments?
I have a couple from Second Life, Jason.
Rick Betts, oh good.
Channel. First one is, how does software that allows people to share their broadband connection affect this subject, like phone?
Well, phone, in this country, phone has a serious problem with the service provider agreements. And if you go back past the stupid candy, back to... The principles, the entitlement to attach devices, even in the PAL, but also in the Martin four principles, the entitlement to attach devices is subject to the service plan. So if your service plan says, thou shalt not share your signal outside the house, or thou shalt not attach computers that do not belong to you, or thou shalt not resell thine service, then that's a real problem. So if phone creates some exemptions to those service plans by making agreements with facilities-based ISPs, then there are not going that. Then the service plan issue goes away because there's that exception. But if not, that's a problem. Was there another one?
Second question. Yeah, another second. Ellen would like to know how these problems work out internationally. Are other countries having these problems? What about where regulations conflict between each other?
Well, good question. I am told that there is no presumption of freedom to connect in places like Singapore and South Korea and so on. And I frankly don't know how they handle it over there. I've been meaning to have some dialogues with people like James Singh and so and it just, it, good question. Anybody else have any ideas? How the lack of freedom to connect plays out in other countries. We know how it plays out in China, and that's not pretty.
Well, there's a, in Scandinavia, is it Denmark or Norway, has the government is running all broadband. One of the Scandinavian countries?
Yeah.
It's government run.
Is South Korea is heavily subsidized broadband?
Yes.
Yeah, but isn't it the government deploying?
But to what extent do governments, other than China, we know in China, I read somewhere just the other day that there are 30,000 people who actually censor websites on the China, Great Firewall of China.
This is an urban myth.
Urban myth?
Yeah.
Not true?
Not documented.
Not documented.
We know how it arose.
Yes.
At least but we also have found it impossible to... confirm or deny, but it is worth denying by virtue of its source or series of sources.
Oh, okay. Thanks.
It was a made-up thing that was then redacted into fact by smart people telling it on webcast. Uh-huh.
Okay. Urban myth alert. it's a really good question how this plays out.
So, ask a question in this context, actually. To me, it seems like this would be the story of backfire. Could we read the story you're telling us in the following way, that back in the old days, we had also in the US, of course, state-owned telcos, monopolies, and heavily regulated for sure. And then there was this wonderful idea of market liberalization.
Right.
And, of course, that went well for some time, right?
Quite and
well.
For some people,
and
but
for
not,
some people,
not,
not for
if
everyone.
You're a CLEC, it didn't go very well.
But there was certainly kind of a momentum to build nice things, such as the web.
Yeah,
To be innovative. And now, in a way, they're some people seem to forget about the history of the networks, as far as I can tell.
Yeah.
That originally the network were funded by taxpayers, right? By money we paid, or you paid.
You paid.
At least I paid tuition. And now I'm wondering, like, and now the property claim comes back, like saying, now these are our pipes, and therefore, you know, we want to get a piece of the cake or of the pie. And now we have this kind of a messy situation, where as opposed to, for instance, some European countries, for sure, the liberalization hasn't been that fast-paced, right? So... It's part an answer to your question, how does it look, or to the other guy's question, how does it look like in different countries? I think in different countries, we still have the idea of a service public, of public service infrastructure, right? Where the basic idea is that we provide infrastructure on non-discriminatory terms. So everyone can basically do certain things. Probably you don't have the unlimited freedom, but still, you don't have discrimination, right? Now it's like a paradox, right? That one would assume, given the US paradigm, that more market means more freedom, generally speaking. But now, if my reading of this story is correct, that this is like a perverse effect of market liberalization to a certain degree, then it may be a kind of a sad story, right?
Mm-hmm.
That
mm-hmm.
regimes or governments, like still democratic governments, like some jurisdictions in Europe, where the state has still some control over networks, may provide, at the end, a more liberal regime and a non-discriminatory regime,
right.
as opposed to a market-driven system where people, the telcos, start to make property crimes.
Uh-huh.
So,
well, markets are just fine if they exist in a dynamic balance with a lot of competitors. But when markets tend towards winner-take-all, then that's where problems can arise. Now, speaking of winner-take-all markets, there, we've seen it in, for example, computer operating systems. But I'm considerably less concerned about computer operating systems. We've seen it in search engines. I'm considerably less concerned about search engines because neither computer operating systems nor search engines have this infrastructure that goes down every street in our country, which is an insurmountable barrier once you assert I own it and I'm free of public service obligations. That is really dangerous territory to me. If you had a market where, I mean, that worked based on some kind of scarcity principle where the supply goes up and the price goes down, and then the supply goes down and the price goes up, and another competitor comes in and gets its share and lowers the price and competes and lowers the price, and if there was kind of a competition like that, that would be a reasonably healthy market, and that was the vision of the 96 Act. But the 96 Act had the incumbents acting against their economic self-interest to do that. And so, unlike Japan, where the incumbent tried to act in its self-interest for about a year, and then the government said, remember, we said you were unbundling the physical infrastructure, and they went, oh, yes, and they unbundled it. But here we had a decade of litigation and regulatory backtracking, and the market that could have existed doesn't exist today.
So I think I'm puzzling in some ways on a simpler level the same thing that Urs is puzzling about this, which is I can't quite figure out in your take on this is whether you trust the government or you don't trust the government. So in some level, a couple of things that you said suggested a deep mistrust, right? The notion that, for instance, you said you can't enforce competition, the entitlement to competition stuff, maybe meant to say different, but I was thinking, you know, it's a whole lot of enforcement of competition law in the United States or in Europe, perhaps more effective than Europe, but certainly here somewhat, if I'm alone or here, it might make the case for DOJ's role in that. In this context, I got a clear sense also that you were concerned with the FCC, bad history of FCC decision-making in this space, you've left too much discretion in this question about rules versus standards versus, you know, precise things, that you don't necessarily trust that adjudication mechanism. On the other hand, I'm also hearing, obviously, a fair amount of skepticism over leaving it more to the market. And I guess I was trying to figure out, as among these things, some of which seem okay to me, some of which don't, and, you know, in a context in which sometimes the government's good and sometimes the government's not good, where do you come down in terms of what the role of the state is, ideally, in getting to a freedom to connect?
Okay. Well, firmly, I believe that sometimes the government is good and sometimes it's not good. Sometimes you can trust them and sometimes you can't.
Right.
Right, exactly. Uh-huh. Good state and bad state. That's really, I don't know if I have any principles or, but What I can say is that I would like to see a state that spoke more about the public good. When I go to an FCC meeting, I hear consumer, 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 consumer. I hardly ever hear citizen. And I hardly ever hear public. And so I have a feeling if I heard my government acting more in terms of public good and less in terms of investment incentives and too much regulation and if I saw the marketplace ramifying and lots of competitors instead of consolidating and there are fewer and fewer competitors every year, I would tend to trust what the government was doing in that space a lot more. Colin.
Can I jump in also to maybe sort of reframe it another way?
Please.
It seems like maybe part of the question is, are we willing to give up a certain amount of regulation, state regulation, over the web in order to keep it an open platform like we have today, in order for markets to thrive in this environment, which will actually create, or could create, a winner-take-all environment where you're going to find essentially finding internet becoming like cable, a tiered service where you have 60 channels and nothing on because you didn't regulate and you left it to the market, and then essentially the pipe owners will, you know, be able to make certain arrangements in the marketplace which will allow discrimination to occur, market-based discrimination. So, you know, that's sort of the conversation that we should be having in terms of how much we're willing to give up in order to let the market decide what the future of the internet's going to look like. Or is this a conversation that we need to be having with regulators and congressmen to say what is an appropriate level of regulation over the internet to keep it open? Or do we just let the market decide and it becomes a much more commercial platform?
Even if you get concrete and think about the last flea market you were at or the last public market in another kind of farmer's market or public market you were at, they all occur in kind of a common space. It might be a common space that's owned by somebody and rents it out, but or a town square or something like that, where all the people come. There's a commons, I believe, underlying every market. And if you look at the places where intramodal competition exists, like the airline industry, where it's very vibrant, very strongly market-driven, you will find underneath that airports that are a commons, more or less, and an air traffic control system that's a commons, more or less. Trucking is another one where you have a lot of different trucking companies, and guess what? The roads are publicly owned, where you find that you can't have intramodal competition, where you need intermodal competition, like, for example, railroads. You'll find that railroads own their own tracks and roadbed and traffic control system. And so when they deregulated railroads, they said, oh, well, the trucks and the ships will compete against them. And so you have intermodal competition. So if you are going to have a vibrant intramodal market where you have a lot of people who are selling internet services or providing wired broadband connections, I believe At some level, you need a commons underneath it, a platform. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned the airline industry, and it's not a perfect commons. I mean, if Northwest Airlines wants to say that they want to push some other carrier out of a particular airport, they have a lot of power and a lot of ability to do that.
That's right.
But that wasn't my real point. What I really wanted to say was to ask really is do you know of any literature that suggests that the reason why the internet came to become important, came to achieve significance, is because people wanting to publish content, people wanting to put content on the internet, had the assumption and could make the assumption validly that everyone in the world would have access to anything that they provided. For example, if I wanted to put up a web page, I would know that that would be available to all the markets who provide access to the internet, not just some particular ones. Now, if you recall from a few months ago, Barbara Van Schaivik came and gave a very interesting talk about the economic principles underlying network neutrality, and essentially concluded that it will always be in the best interest of carriers to discriminate based upon content providers.
Yes,
and
it will.
And in the rights provider, it will always be. And there's no way to get around that reality. So my question is, why is it that this hasn't happened sooner? Is it just some artifact of the evolution of the technology that happened to have occurred, or what?
This happened sooner. This meaning?
Actually being confronted with carriers providing discriminatory access to services.
This is the first few years that they've actually had the technology at an affordable price where they can. It's the means to the motive and they now have means and opportunity in addition to motive.
Right. I guess the question
they never did before.
Right. So I guess my question is twofold. One, are there any arguments that suggest that the fact that it was a commons was important in the future, in the early development of the internet? That's part one. And part two is, why is it that technology to discriminate had not developed sooner?
Does anybody else have a burning question? Okay.
Just Wendy Seltzer from IRC, just on the IRC channel, just wanted to say that her sense about the regulation was that the question really is not who we trust, but who we least mistrust.
Who do we least mistrust?
That's very good. Wendy Seltzer asked. Excellent.
So you had a two-part question, and what's his name's disease has already infected my brain.
So part one is have there been any serious arguments that the early early internet growth was the result of assumptions that people were making about the universality of their content?
Okay, and the second one was
haven't technologies to provide discriminatory access to resources evolved soon?
Okay. The second one is easy to answer, and that is that those technologies require really fancy processing, and if they've been available sooner, they've been expensive and network limiting. Now they're increasingly not. This deep packet inspection can run at OC48, and it couldn't before, or it could, but only for gazillion-dollar boxes that black three-letter agencies could afford.
But before there weren't OC48s, right?
It's taken a while for the deep packet inspection to catch up with the just raw packet relaying. Question number one is, has there been a cognizance of the benefits of having a commons? And the best answer is that when they is in that first computer inquiry to distinction between basic services and enhanced services, when we had the dial-up internet and the telephone companies went wait a minute, we don't have to provide lines to that ISP. We don't like that ISP. Or, you know, we think they ought to pay. And the FCC said, nope, thou shalt, at non-discriminatory rates. That allowed the internet to grow. And there were a lot of other decisions about, reciprocal compensation and so on around that. But basically, because the dial-up network was viewed as a public accommodation, the dial-up internet could grow and all kinds of competitive ISPs could flourish for a while. That was temporary. Now, I don't know if you've heard, but for the very first time that I know of, Verizon has asserted that Global Naps, a company in Quincy, Verizon asserted that they are going to charge Global Naps per minute pricing for people who dial up the internet. And Global Naps said no, and they fought it, and they lost, and Verizon cut off their service, and thereby disrupting 28 independent dial-up ISPs that were using Global Naps dial-in service just last weekend.
I have a friend who lost his /28 over that.
Yeah. So that's actually a big reversal of that principle that comes out of CI2. Apparently, you know, it's very complicated and deep into regulatory law, and so since I don't know anything about it, and it's long past time to stop, I'm going to stop.
Awesome. Thank you
all. And you out in Second Life.
And do you want to do one last plug for One Web Day next week?
Oh, and one last plug. One Web Day. One Web Day is, here, have a button. One Web Day will, the very first worldwide One Web Day will be on September 22nd. And you and your community and we in our community are trying to think up really good ways to celebrate One Web Day. One Web Day celebrates the health and diversity of the internet. There's going to be a Cambridge local One Web Day brainstorming party a week from today at 7 p.m. at John Harvard's Brew Pub, 33 Dunster Street. Believe Susan Crawford will be there.
She will.
Okay. Okay, so she's been IM'd. And do we have her lined up for lunch talk yet?
I can come to lunch, but you can probably do Fellows Hour around. Okay. She's no focused evening thing as the lunch.
Oh, very good. Okay, so Fellows Hour, but we'll... No.
Lunch in the evening. Lunch at John Harvard.
Yes. Anyway, and so in the spirit of One Web Day and the open, non-discriminatory internet, thank you all.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.